at these conventions, since we have the opportunity for people to actually appear here and make presentations, rather than when you write an article, you can only imagine what they are talking about. With the conventions, we can actually give presentations. And so here is another example of strivings to reproduce the recordings in the way that they really should be. And this presentation is by Barton Wimble.
Well, this is not the first 78 you've seen today. I thought it might be the actual first record we'd look at in the convention, but I was wrong. But anyway, this object in my hand is a lump of shellac compound that's been formed into a disc by heat and pressure. And there are circular striations on both sides, and on both sides there are little pieces of round paper that have writing and graphics on them. And this is an archaic method of sound reproduction, commonly called a 78. So let us speculate what this 78 might be, and what it might be worth, and to whom. If the label, which I know you will immediately know is not true, if the label proved that it originated in 1904 in Milan, and the artist's name was Angelica Pandolfini, a Japanese collector would indeed bundle up $5,000 worth of yen, hop into a jet, go to Brazil just to pick it up. Is it worth $1,000 plus a minute to listen to Madame Pandolfini? Well, I don't think we need ask the Japanese collector, because to my knowledge, he's never played the record. And if he did, his equipment is not good enough that he could actually tell what was in the grooves. All he knows is that he owns one of the rarest records in the world. If, however, the label proved that it was also from Milan and it was 2 years earlier, and the artists were a tenor named Enrico Caruso, the disc would probably be worth about 1/100th that of the Pandolfini. So obviously we cannot judge the artistic value of a record by its rarity, because what we've been talking about has nothing to do with art. It's a physical object that we're talking about, and the worth of that physical object. So if we merely say that a record is a physical object, which many people do, and many people collect them only because of the physical qualities of them and the rarity, then the quality and the actual value is in doubt. There's an easy way, for example, to tell you exactly what this record is worth. Nothing. It's worth absolutely nothing. That's what it's worth. It's worth nothing now, obviously.
Maybe
do a
label collection.
Now.
Broke the label.
Broke the label, right. Now, remember that if we're archivists, and if we are transcription and transfer engineers, we may have actually saved the artistic value of that record. It may not be worth anything right now, but if we have done our work right, and if we have made judgments that the record was worth something at one point, and it needn't be a broken record. It can be a record we sold, a record we lost. It can be a record we borrowed and had to give back. And the only way we'll ever know whether that record had any artistic value or not is to hear what was in the grooves when we put the needle down. Which is Lieder tape.
Thank you.
Of course, Arturo Toscanini and the New York Philharmonic March, 1929. The question really is this prelude to Act One of Traviata less valuable to those who love great conducting or great Verdi than those who love great tenors or obscure G&T sopranos? The physical value of that disc is 1/1000th of the Pandolfini. What we've managed to do, however, is to transfer, as transfer engineers, is to isolate the physical and the artistic value of the disc into separate entities. We've really done much more than that. I could choose, albeit with some legal risk, to duplicate what we've just heard 1,000 times, and I could distribute that to everyone who wanted to hear Toscanini and Verdi, and the impact would be the same as if the disc still existed. That's the power of modern technology. But really, that's only the rawest and the least refined transfer engineering, because it represents only a carefully supervised mechanical process. The creation of that process was obviously an awesome and very lengthy process, accomplished by many pioneers. I don't know whether Dick Burns is here or not, but he certainly is one of them. Saul Marantz is another one. And by many other engineers who craftily utilized technology that was never intended to be restoration technology, but which turned out to be highly inventive and useful. The specific inventions and the reuse of other scientific achievements was the completion of what I choose to call phase one of audio restoration. Phase one first made itself known to a really wide public when the first internationally famous transfer engineer, who was A.C. Griffith, working with EMI in England, brought the realization of how good historical recordings could sound under contemporary playback conditions. Theirs was the founding fathership of modern restoration techniques. And while the process was being invented and refined and redefined, the men involved had to have a number of qualifications which were very rare indeed. And one of these was high engineering technological training, inventive capabilities such as Dick Burns. And they had to document and pass on all of their findings to others. This was a process which no mere interest in records or interest in music could possibly have produced. It required a much higher level of technical expertise. That really was the final phase final part of phase one, was when all of this information was codified and passed on to other people. Phase one, however, opened miraculous doors to the past. For there is, certainly with the exception of motion pictures, no medium so capable of recalling the past, I don't believe, as sound recordings. Take Warsaw, for example, in 1910, a city still under Russian domination, and unknowingly facing two world wars and the extinction of a large part of its population and a large part of its culture. Yet we may, with our technology, relive a voice, a sacred place in that city, and a way of life now gone forever.
Where I am, 'cause I'm on you. That was the great cantor, Gershon Sirota, singing Make Our Sins White from Warsaw. I believe the record was recorded about 1910. I don't have the numbers, the matrixes, nor the exact dates because I'm going to play music today. Not only that, but to some, that record of Cantor Sirota, is that record is probably more meaningful and more moving than all the operatic records ever made, because it represents something that is no longer in existence. But to me, to be ecumenical, we can reverse the historical perspective and we can hear a voice coming from an actual physical place very much with us. Though the voice, the music, and the style are far, far more moribund than what we've heard from Cantor Sirota's timeless service. Besides, to me, it's he's the Mrs. Miller of ecclesiastical music. What can I tell you? The piece was Oremus pro Pontifice by somebody by the name of Calzanera, and fortunately, he seems to be a composer that's completely disappeared. These two examples really were meant to display the byways of the archival heritage that we can place in front of the contemporary listener. Would the physical object of those shellac discs have any meaning to those who are only interested in listening and in the music and not in the label or the pressing or the matrixes? Probably very little. First of all, most people wouldn't know what the object meant, and secondly, they wouldn't know how to play it. And now we come to what I'd like to call phase two of the art of sonic restoration. Bluntly put, the basic technical knowledge and demands of first-class transfer technology are now simple enough to be taught anyone who has the ability to cope with a home computer. We can now teach the art to those who really are most qualified to practice it. It is those, the lifelong students and the self-taught experts in the field of historical sound, of which probably the greatest gathering in the United States is before me right now. There are virtually no courses to be had in this art. There are no teachers. And if you're not inner-motivated to learn the intricacies of both the musical and historical aspects of historic sound, you probably never will. There are no textbooks, and there are no universities. And really, engineers cannot spend their time learning the arcane symbols of audio archaeology. They have a more important task, to further the development of methods and equipment to make the next phase of restoration even better than we're doing today. And it's up to us to see that the next generation of pack burns and the next breakthrough in such things as digital filling are funded and taken forward. A labor of love coupled with the latest in technology, if it emanates from the same person, is the answer to uncovering and restoring and disseminating the buried gems of all parts of recorded history. Let the engineers start teaching the scholars. But enough of this philosophizing. Let's not get carried away by high art and such. As we've seen, most of the sounds recorded on commercial discs were patently commercial, to be enjoyed by the public at large and then forgotten in the wave of the next new sounds to come along. Like this vivid reminder, when I get the tape wound forward, of a Broadway that is long, long gone. Warren Ziegfeld's cheaper by the hour substitute for John McCormick, John Steele. And the record is from the Ziegfeld Follies of 1919. And it's called Tulip Time, obviously. And one can almost hear Flo Ziegfeld saying over the phone, give me 5 minutes of tulip music for the Dutch windmill number, and I need it by 10 tonight. So to keep the light, not to say insubstantial tone for a few more moments, let's use a bit of restoration to lay to rest once and for all one of the most controversial records ever issued on popular 78s. When this Black Label Victor came out, I believe in the early 1930s, everyone who had heard about this record had very different ideas about what the lyrics really said.
Like a Christmas tree. I'll sail the seas until I croak. I'll fight and swear and drink and smoke, but I can't swim a bloody stroke.
That's Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
In the door.
Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'll rare and tear and rant and roar.
That's Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'll spin your yarns and tell your lies. I'll drink your wine and eat your pies. I'll kiss your cheeks and black your eyes.
That's Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
Did anybody want a repeat of that last? Just to convince yourself. That was Hoagie Carmichael, Benny Goodman, Gene Krupa, Bix Beiderbecke, Tommy Dorsey, and the vocals by Carson Robinson. Barnacle Bill the whatever.
Which take?
I have no idea. I have no idea which take. Did they do that on every take?
No.
Oh.
Only one of the three.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, this is the fun one, obviously. This is probably the late one. About 4 a.m, maybe. But to sum up, taking technology to its foremost point and entrusting it to the people who know and love the records is fine. But what's the real advantage other than the satisfaction of hearing something better than it may have ever been heard before? I think there are many, and I think many of them are very important. First, there is a large group, a sizable population of very sensitive music lovers who will accept, if not absolutely relish, old recordings if they are reproduced well enough not to offend current audio sensibilities. I have yet to find a serious Beethoven student who would not listen and enjoy in every sense of the word the Fifth Symphony conducted by Richard Strauss. And one can extrapolate that into virtually every field of music. Then there's the matter of media and critical attention. Major magazines, newspapers, and radio will begin to pay attention if the musical material and the audibility are equally fascinating. And I might merely point out that when a 1928 Mengelberg recording is named by Newsweek magazine as one of the best listening experiences of 1983, it's an achievement of sorts. I have found, and collectors, let's talk about collectors. Those crazy, fanatic, lovable people who can be coaxed into endless details, endless matrix numbers, endless dates, but more than that, they can also be coaxed into the rarest recordings, and especially in these days when record collecting is becoming a hobby pretty much confined in the upper limits to well-to-do people. Grants and gifts, if they think that that particular brand of treasures that they really like are going to shine forth as they've never been able to hear them before. In fact, I hope I'm correct, but I believe that the basic funding for the AAA cataloging project was a major gift from a man who is basically a music lover. But a final sound from the past. History means the study of continuity. And for some special artists, the length and the depth of their recording careers can be traced in multiple ways. Perhaps no conductor more so than Leopold Stokowski, particularly since he re-recorded so many items at various points on the up and down scale of his long career. To say earlier was better for Stokowski is both simplistic and often inaccurate. But there was a golden age for Stokowski, and I'm referring obviously to something other than his hair color. And I can find no greater expression of it than this 1930 Philadelphia Orchestra disc of his own orchestral transcription of Debussy's In Gulf Cathedral. It is a vibrant moment in music, but it happened in one place at one time with one orchestra that could never be repeated again. And our ability to bring it to everyone is indeed timeless.
the area.
Right. Okay, David and crew, if you'd like to come forward and figure out how you want to set up, we can pull the speaker down off of this table since